You are listening to an ADIS Journal podcast.
Welcome to this podcast, where we spotlight evolving science, patient needs, and innovation in multiple myeloma when patients relapse after their initial line of therapy. I'm Ajay Nuka. I'm a professor in the Department of Hematology Oncology at the Emory University Winship Cancer Institute.
Thank you, Ajay, and hello, everyone. My name is Roberto Mina. I'm a hematologist at the Winship Cancer Institute, same institution as Dr. Nuka.
Thank you, Roberto. The big question to address today is it still acceptable to use traditional standards of care for patients with second line and beyond when the novel treatments are demonstrating unprecedented long-term outcomes? And how are innovations going to change the options available for our myeloma patients? In this podcast, we will share our thoughts on the existing unmet needs for patients with second-line therapy and beyond, and how therapies targeting the B-cell maturation antigen have transformed the treatment landscape and the use of BCMA-targeted bispecific antibodies in the earlier lines of therapy in multiple myeloma.
So we've seen the evolution of the initial treatment for patients with newly diagnosed multiple myeloma. And we've seen in the recent years this transition between triplets and quadruplets, the addition of monoclonal antibodies targeting CD38. So Ajay, what are the currently recommended initial regimens and the approaches to patients with newly diagnosed myeloma?
Great question, Roberto. As we saw the evolution from the doublets to the triplets to the quadruplets, we're seeing these unprecedented response rates with the initial induction therapies, both in the transplant-eligible patients as well as the transplant-ineligible patients. Let me focus on the transplant-eligible patients. So we start to use the immunomodulatory agents, the proteasome inhibitors, the CD38 monoclonal antibodies, as well as the steroids, the combo of these quadruplets, revealing us response rates as close to 100% overall response rates among all these transplant-eligible patients. The same applies for the transplant-ineligible patients as well.
So in the past, we had this difference between the outcomes that we were able to obtain between transplant-eligible patients, patients that were fitter, able to tolerate more intensive treatment, including transplant. But now, with the adoption of quadruplets, we're seeing the outcomes becoming closer and closer, right? So we have the several studies now that have introduced the use of quadruplets based on VRd plus daratumumab and isatuximab, leading to high response rates, MRD negativity rates almost as close as those we've seen in transplant-eligible patients. So I would say that today we can confidently use quadruplets for a transplant-ineligible and eligible, knowing that still triplets such as DRD is an effective regimen for the frailest population.
Awesome. That's amazing where we were and where we are today. And the usage of transplant in the United States is probably in 30% of all newly diagnosed myeloma patients. The other 70% of the patients do not receive a transplant. Yet, what these novel studies have shown was the usage of quadruplets, even among the transplant-ineligible patients or the transplant-deferred patients, yielding to the response rates that Roberto was quoting about. The MRD negative rates are so good that we're able to reach an MRD negativity in the majority of the patients. So if you think about the transplant delivering those depths of responses to reach that MRD negativity and the maintenance, continuing to maintain those responses towards a sustained MRD, we are making headway in the right way in the transplant-ineligible patients.
So we've seen that the transformation of frontline treatment and what means in terms of patients' prognosis. We know that we have, with current regimens, the median progression-free survival with PERSU, CEPHEUS, REMERALD is far from being reached. We know that we can expect from patient eligible for transplant more than a decade, or maybe even longer than that with PERSUs, and almost close to 100 months of expected projected PFS for CEPHEUS. So great news for patients. However, we know that still a significant fraction of patients will relapse and their disease will be resistant to treatment that so far are being administered almost until progression, not all, but many of them. So Ajay, what do you think this reflects into the second line treatment? Do you think this poses a challenge to clinicians and patients in treating patients at relapse?
This is an great way of putting things together, Roberto. Thank you for bringing up that the frontline prolonged remissions that one can expect to see with these quadruplet regimens. As you were alluding to, it is just unbelievable. Even a decade ago, we were not even thinking about these kinds of responses one would be anticipating. So now expecting a median PFS of beyond 15 years is just unbelievable. Yet the patient population at the time of a first relapse, one has to understand, is not the same as what we were dealing with almost a decade ago. So these patients are more refractory, had exposure and refractoriness to all three drug classes, particularly the IMiDs, as well as the proteasome inhibitors. This highlights the need for starting to focus on the type of a patient that we are dealing with at the first relapse. It is not the same as what we had been used to using in the past. So what the challenge that we face today is, we do not know what is driving these relapses. So we know what the exposures are. And one can think about if daratumumab and the other first-line agents, such as the IMiDs, exhibit both the direct on-tumor and the immunomodulatory mechanisms of action. While the direct on-tumor effects may wane over time, the immunomodulatory effects of data may still apply regardless of the prior anti-CD38 antibody exposure. To make it more difficult to interpret, there is limited data on retreatment with the anti-CD38 antibody in the early line therapies. So patients with refractoriness to anti-CD38 antibodies defined by the IMWG or the International Myeloma Working Group are the disease that is non-responsive to therapy or that progresses within 60 days of the last line of therapy. It may still benefit from the anti-CD38 treatments in the second line, and clearly alluding to the combinations that we really have in place, especially the daratumumab treatments with the novel antibodies targeting BCMA that can deliver synergistic effects that are independent of daratumumab's direct anti-myeloma activity, and even in the daratumumab-exposed patients. So my peeve, all patients, regardless of the prior exposure, will require novel options beyond recycling of the traditional standard of care options. What do you think, Roberto?
I think this is absolutely true, and I think this is the next challenge, how to tailor treatment based on several factors that are treatment exposure, potentially also disease-related factors, and of course, patient-related factors. And this, in fact, brings us to the next topic, which is what kind of treatments can we use and are available nowadays at relapse, and what kind of considerations drive your treatment selection?
So the one motto that everybody should move forward with is to be able to deliver the best therapy available for that specific patient at the time. We're not in the business of saving treatments for a later time. We want the patient to use the best available treatment, get to the deepest remission, and let the patients enjoy that remission for the longest period. As you understand, Roberto, myeloma is characterized by increased attrition. With every line of therapy, you lose patients. You lose patients to not receiving the next line of therapy. This attrition increases and increases and increases, so it makes more sense for us to start using the best available option as early as possible in the relapse regimen. The appropriate relapse regimen should be selected based on the rate of disease progression and the patient characteristics, such as the patient fitness and the patient comorbidities. So there is a component of personal preference and the factors impacting the patient's quality of life, such as the adverse event priorities. So, and not only that, the treatment convenience. So if a patient is living 4 hours away, is it optimal for us to give a weekly dosing for this specific patient to bring the patient every 4 hours? Requirements for the hospitalizations. Patients could have multiple other things that they'd be doing. They'd be caregivers for somebody else. So all those need to be taken into considerations, and including minimizing the steroid-related toxicities as well. And all these should help to guide the treatment choice. The treatment selection should include the patient's decision-making. So it should be a shared decision-making, making sure that the patient is well-informed about the adverse events, about the benefits versus the risks of every potential regimen. The treatment sequencing also should be considered how usage of one treatment might have an impact on the future treatments. Would one of these treatments that we're using now does it have a potential to cannibalize the future treatments? So among the traditional standard of care treatments, there are different anti-CD38 based standard antibody regimens, such as daratumumab, pomalidomide, and dexamethasone from the Apollo trial, daratumumab, bortezomib, and dexamethasone from the CASTOR trial, daratumumab, carfilzomib, and dexamethasone from the CANDOR trial, or using isatuximab, carfilzomib, and dexamethasone. This may be still used for patients that are sensitive or with no refractoriness to anti-CD38 antibodies. For those patients that are anti-CD38 refractory, the traditional regimens such as carfilzomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone, this was from the ASPIRE trial, this can be considered for lenalidomide-sensitive patients. How about those patients that are lenalidomide refractory? Carfilzomib and dexamethasone from the ENDEAVOR trial, or carfilzomib, pomalidomide, dexamethasone, this is from a phase 2 trial, showing the benefit of these regimens in the lenalidomide refractory space, could be potential options. Selinexor-based options, such as the selinexor, bortezomib, dexamethasone from the BOSTON trial, or the pomalidomide, bortezomib, dexamethasone from the OPTIMISM trial, and these are all potential options that could be considered for patients that have refractoriness to lenalidomide and anti-CD38 antibody. It is important to note that most studies of PI, IMiD, and anti-CD38 antibody regimens in the early relapse setting included a limited number of patients with prior exposure or refractoriness to lenalidomide or anti-CD38 antibodies. Outcomes of these standard of care regimens have been largely suboptimal in the lenalidomide refractory patients. So there are systemic reviews in patients that have received more than one prior line of therapy. These have very short progression-free survivals. Progression-free survival of 8.8 months in the len-refractory cohort versus 13.8 months in the intent-to-treat populations. In addition to these traditional standard of care regimens, immunotherapy is targeting BCMA on the myeloma cells, including the CAR-T and the antibody drug conjugates, are novel treatment options available for early line myeloma therapies. And now that these are approved options very early in the course, can we go over the data to show what kind of a benefit each of these regimens yield in this space of the early relapse?
Sure. Let's start with CAR T cell. So we have in Cilta-cel, which is a BCMA CAR T cell product approved in patients that have received at least one prior line of therapy that are len refractory and exposed to a PI. So Cilta-cel was approved based on results of the CARTITUDE-4 study, which compare a single infusion of Cilta-cel to continuous therapy with either Dara-Pom-Dex or PVD. And Cilta-cel met the primary endpoint of the study, which was progression-free survival with an overall survival benefit. So we have a PFS benefit, hazard ratio of 0.29, and a 0.55 survival benefit. So Cilta-cel clearly showed that, as opposed to a non-BCMA targeting option, was able to induce deeper remission that were longer, that translated into a longer progression-free survival. Now at 3 years almost of follow-up, we don't have a median PFS yet, and also an overall survival benefit. Cilta-cel has the advantage of being kind of a one-and-done treatment. Patient underwent leukapheresis, received bridging therapy, and then a single infusion of Cilta-cel. We know, however, that CAR T-cell therapy, despite being extremely effective, high potent, also comes with specific side effects. Some of them are shared with bispecific antibodies, CRS and ICANS, and I believe these are not limiting factors for the recommendation of CAR T-cell. We know how to deal with this, but certainly long-term, we have some, although rare, important side effects, non-ICANS, neurotox, cranial nerve palsies, and other immune effector cell adverse events. So all these are certainly a potential issue with CAR T. We know also that some patients will have a rapidly proliferating disease that require an aggressive bridging therapy. Sometimes bridging therapy is not available, or patient cannot wait, or conditions of the patient can deteriorate so the patient is no longer eligible for CAR T cell therapy. So CAR T is certainly an exceptional treatment, but probably in the real practice, not every single patient can be treated with CAR T cell, either because of the disease or because of the patient's conditions. We have other options. We have seen two studies leading to positive results with an ADC that targets BCMA. So same target, different mechanisms of action. So AJ, can you tell us a little bit about the BELA combinations?
Clinical trials of belantamab-based combinations have shown positive results in patients who have received more than one prior line of therapy. Based on the DREAM-7 and DREAM-8 studies, DREAM-7 evaluating belantamab bortezomib dexamethasone and DREAM-8 evaluating bortezomib pomalidomide dexamethasone. These regimens are approved in 2+ lines of therapy in Europe, UK, and Japan. And belantamab bortezomib dexamethasone is approved for use in third-line setting in the United States. In the DREAM-7 trial of belantamab bortezomib dexamethasone, or BVD, 52% of the patients had prior exposure to lenalidomide, 34% had refractoriness to lenalidomide, and nearly all, 99% of the patients were anti-CD38 naive. And BVD demonstrated a median PFS of 36 months, an overall response rate of 83%, and MRD response rates, who have complete response or better, seen in 25% of the patients. These results in the early line of therapy with a combination of belantamab, bortezomib, dexamethasone over daratumumab, bortezomib, dexamethasone. In the DREAM-8 trial, which evaluated belantamab, pomalidomide, dexamethasone, all patients had prior lenalidomide exposure. 26% had prior exposure to anti-CD38 therapy, and 24% had refractoriness to anti-CD38 therapy. At a median follow-up of 36 months, the median PFS was 32.6 months with the belantamab, pomalidomide, dexamethasone, with CR rates of or greater in 43%, and 28% of these patients achieved MRD negativity. Belantamab represents the first off-the-shelf BCMA-targeted option for second-line myeloma outside the United States and third-line setting in the United States, which may allow for broader patient access to this treatment. Despite the positive results of the DREAM-7 and DREAM-8, belantamab mafodotin combinations have uncertainties of the dosing strategy, so the optimal usage is yet to be confirmed. The ocular toxicities need an ophthalmologist or an optometrist management through the dosing schedules and prior to every dose. The management of these ocular events can be guided by regular monitoring, supportive care, and delaying or reducing the dose over time. In the same lines, Roberto, we spoke about CAR-T, we spoke about ADC. Can you talk about the bispecific antibodies targeting BCMA?
So we've heard about CAR-T cell, we heard about belantamab, but we now also have another way to target BCMA, which is with a bispecific antibody, which is specifically is brought to early lines thanks to the results of TEC-3, MAJESTIC-3, which combine teclistamab and daratumumab for patients with 1 to 3 prior lines of therapy. So we have used for a number of years bispecific antibodies, single agent in late lines based on the pivotal results of studies such as MAJESTIC-1 with teclistamab, such as Linker with Linvo, and also Magnetism-3 with elranatamab. And all of this study showed in a very heavily pretreated population, most of patients being triple class refractory to a PI, an IMiD, and CD38, yielding as a single agent drug in patients with 5-6 million prior lines of therapy, responses in the range of 60-65%, complete remission rates in up to 50%, and a very, very long durability of those responses in late line. So the fair question then was, can these responses and the PFS and DOS that we've seen in late lines become even better when these drugs are used in earlier lines, either single agent or in combination, when patients are more fit, but also that their immune system is fitter because they have seen less treatment? And so TECDERA applies this concept of moving teclistamab earlier on in patients with less heavily pretreated disease. So MAJESTIC-3 is the first phase 3 randomized study that compare teclistamab used in an early line of therapy in combination with daratumumab. And patients that were randomized to receive either teclistamab and daratumumab, with teclistamab that was administered every 4 weeks starting from cycle 7 onwards, or standard of care at physician's discretion, which was Darapon Dex or DARA-VD. All patients enrolled in MajesTEC 3 were lenalidomide exposed, and the vast majority of them, in fact, were also lenalidomide refractory, while 5% of patients in both arms were exposed to daratumumab. And what the DARA and MajesTEC 3 have shown to us is that the combination of these two drugs, TEC and DARA, yielded responses with complete remission rate 80% of patients, 60% of patients being in complete remission and MRD negative at 10 to the minus 5. And this translated into a progression-free survival probability at 3 years of 83%, which is one of the best, if not the best, progression-free survival that we have seen in studies testing combinations in early relapse refractory multiple myeloma. And importantly also, TECDARA showed at the 3-year follow-up already an overall survival advantage favoring TECDARA versus DARA-PD or DARA-VD. And this is important because it tells us that when we use this combination early on, we not only see a benefit in terms of responses and durability of responses, but this has an effect also on the overall survival already at a quite early time point. And in terms of safety, what did the TEC 3 showed? Well, the safety profile was very much consistent and in line with what we have seen in the more heavily pretreated population. The cytokine release syndrome rate is more or less what we've seen with single agent teclistamab in the range of 60%. The ICANS, so the immunity neurotoxicity, is unlikely to happen. Very few patients had an ICANS event. And what is instead the most important side effects related to the use of a BCMA targeting bispecific antibody, such as teclistamab, is the risk of infection. The majority of patients actually experience at least one infection, and more than 50% of patients, 54% of patients, had infections grade 3 or higher. It is important to notice that the infection rates were higher during the first 6 months, where we have a number of factors, not just treatment, but also the immune suppression carried by uncontrolled disease. After the first 6 months, the infections tended to decrease, and this may be due to a number of factors. Again, the fact that the disease was in control for those patients, so less immune suppression. There was a monthly switch in terms of teclistamab dosing, which may have helped. And of course, we also need to reinforce the use of an aggressive immunoglobulin replacement therapy approach, because this has been demonstrated to be an intervention that can make a difference in terms of reducing the risk of infections when specific targeted BCMA are being used. So having said that, we've seen great results in terms of efficacy, safety profile in line with what we know for teclistamab, but this is a combination. So this is TEC and DARA. And as we have mentioned at the beginning of this podcast, some patients will relapse and eventually become refractory, not only to lenalidomide, to PI, but also to daratumumab. So what about the use of single agent BCMA targeting bispecific antibody? What do we know about this, Ajay?
Great overview of what the TEC 3 data was clearly delivering. The biggest question is all about the what happens with the DARA refractory patients or the DARA exposed patients who had previously seen daratumumab in the induction therapies, like you were alluding to before. Majority of the patients would be receiving a quadruplet therapy. And would the results of TEC 3 be applicable for that specific patient population? And that is a big question. So TEC 9 study will help us to inform the usage of teclistamab as early line of therapy among patients who have previously seen daratumumab. So TEC 9 is the first randomized phase 3 study of teclistamab as monotherapy versus the traditional arms of pomalidomide, bortezomib, dexamethasone, or carfilzomib, dexamethasone among patients that had seen 1 to 3 prior lines of therapy and had a prior exposure to an anti-CD38 antibody, as well as lenalidomide. Majority of the patients on this study were refractory to lenalidomide and anti-CD38 antibody. 79% of the patients are refractory to lenalidomide. 85% of the patients are refractory to anti-CD38 antibody. The results of MajesTEC 9 build on the results of the Majestic 3, which is a TECTERA, demonstrating a significant PFS as well as the overall survival benefit with teclistamab as monotherapy in a more heavily refractory patient population. In addition to the Majestic 3 and the Majestic 9, there are additional data sets that have demonstrated the favorable potential. So the results from the TREM2 trial, this is a small cohort, as well as the Majestic 4, 5, and 7, all of these support the combinations. So I'm curious about your take on the combo of bispecific antibody as well as the GPRC5D bispecific antibody here.
We also know that there are other drugs that target different antigens. One of them is GPRC5D, which is targeted by talquetamab, which is a bispecific antibody. And as we've seen, teclistamab and other bispecific antibodies moving forward to the earlier lines of therapy, the same is happening for talquetamab. And we have a couple of studies, phase three large studies, Monumental 3 and Monumental 6, that are exploring the role of talquetamab in earlier lines. So Monumental 3, for example, is exploring the combination of talc with daratumumab, so kind of a Majestic 3 approach, with or without pomalidomide. And in Monumental 6, on the other hand, we have the combination of talc with only pom or the combination of tec and talc. There are several other bispecific antibodies that target BCMA, and certainly the efficacy that we've seen has brought a lot of excitement about their development of this platform. So now we have other drugs such as linvoseltamab and elranatamab being explored in earlier lines of therapy. This either as a single agent like linvoseltamab in the LINKER-MM study that is comparing linvo to elopomdex in patients with at least one prior line of therapy. Elranatamab has been tested as well in combination with daratumumab. One question for you, Ajay, is that now that we have discussed all of the data, CAR T, ADC, and also bispecifics, what do you think should be a general recommendation for our colleagues that have to use these drugs every day in terms of sequencing? What do we know? What do the guidelines recommend?
Absolutely. The IMWG has provided some guidance based on the sequencing. What would be the most appropriate sequencing when you have BCMA bispecifics, BCMA CAR-Ts, BCMA ADCs, as well as the GPRC5D bispecific antibodies that are existing out there, and there are more in the future to come. One of the key principles that we talked about earlier was the usage of one treatment should not have an impact on the efficacy of the following treatment. So that should be always in the mind of the user. So when you talk about a BCMA CAR-T, it's a one-and-done therapy, just like we talked about, Roberto. And these patients have a prolonged duration of remission. And at the time when the patient is progressing, these patients have an option of receiving either a BCMA bispecific antibody or a GPRC5D bispecific antibody. So if you flip the other way, if the patients are receiving the BCMA bispecific antibody or the GPRC5D bispecific antibody, these patients are receiving ongoing therapy, either by themselves or with combinations. At the time when they progress, the option of a CAR-T likely may not yield the best response. And in terms of the other sequencing approaches, so a BCMA bispecific antibody followed by another BCMA bispecific antibody or a GPRC5D bispecific antibody, this should always have a sandwich of a non-T-cell redirecting therapy to let those T-cells get some free time to recuperate.
And we've not mentioned the fact that targeting BCMA and T-cell redirecting therapies are certainly the new cornerstone of myeloma treatment, but there are also other compounds that are making their way up in the treatment of myeloma. We've seen, for example, CELMoDs, and we've seen iberdomide and mezigdomide being two highly active compounds. And this, we'll see positive results soon. But it's also interesting to see how these drugs can be combined with bispecific antibodies to make the most out of both both mechanisms of action and both kind of drugs. So I think it's a very exciting time for myeloma.
Very nice, wonderful. If you have to focus on three things that everybody that's receiving BCMA bispecific antibodies should be focused on, what would those three things be?
So I think that the good thing with bispecific antibodies is that we really don't have an exclusion criteria, let's say. I think more or less everybody can receive a bispecific antibody. Three pieces of advice would be that It is important to be fully aware of the side effects, particularly the acute side effects. We know that these are well standardized. We know there are also preventative measures. CRS is maybe an issue, even more logistical than clinical also in some patients. We know that, for example, tocilizumab is a very good drug to prevent cytokine release syndrome and allow for the outpatient administration, which I think is absolutely feasible, but we need to have a plan to ensure that patient safety. So we need to select the right patient and have a plan and a setup to deliver these drugs in an outpatient, more patient-friendly setting, but also in a safe way. And I think the third piece of advice would be to be cognizant of the risk of infection. So IG replacement therapy, and in the very first months of treatment, be very vigilant. And hopefully in the future, we will be able also to identify those patients at high risk of infection and adopt some kind of prophylaxis beyond the standard prophylaxis that we currently use.
Thanks, everyone, for your time. So we had an excellent discussion from Roberto and me talking about what the standard of care option should be for the second line and beyond therapies in early relapse myeloma, especially with the focus on their bispecific antibodies and their combinations yielding us such good benefits. We realize that the traditional standard of care options are less effective in increasingly resistant populations. CAR-T, particularly with cell-to-cell, is a powerful, powerful ammunition that every myeloma patient should be aware of and every provider should be ready to use. But this should be considered as an initial treatment option earlier on with all the available treatment options that are brewing. The readily available belantamab-mafodotin combinations may be considered after more effective therapies have been explored.
And so in this context, targeting BCMA with a bispecific antibody, such as teclistamab, either in combination or monotherapy, represents the next evolution and the next treatment option for patients as early as the second line therapy. And this is almost a steroid-free immunotherapy that offers also the convenience of being readily available, off the shelf, being used also in the community setting with some mitigation strategies also for side effects and also the potential for monthly administration. So overall, certainly bispecific antibodies, including teclistamab, do represent a new standard of care for this patient population. So we reached the end of this podcast. On behalf of my co-author, Dr. Nuka, thank you very much for attending this podcast. We hope that you enjoyed it as much as we did. And it was a pleasure discussing BCMA and second-line treatment with you all. Wish a great day.
You can listen to more podcasts by subscribing to ADIS Journal Podcasts with your preferred podcast provider or by visiting the journal website. For a full list of declarations, including funding and author disclosure statements and copyright information, please visit the article page on the journal website. The link to the article page can be found in the podcast description.